It is Friday, June the 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, Britain deciding whether to leave the EU with impact already felt on financial markets.
It's been a few days of tremendous market volatility, just depending on what the opinion polls were saying.
Also ahead, historic agreement for Colombians, U.S. First Lady to visit Liberia.
Mrs. Obama's trip to Liberia, we understand, is part of the Let Girls Learn initiative.
Also ahead, political volatility here in Washington. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Voting has ended in Britain's historic referendum that will decide whether the country remains in the European Union. VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez joins us now from London. Luis, I understand the weather couldn't have been more uncooperative on Thursday, yet large numbers of voters actually ended up at the polls undaunted by the weather.
Turnout was extraordinarily high. More than 70% came to the polls on Thursday. That was despite torrential rain in eastern and southern England all day Thursday, pretty much. And so that made it very difficult for people to get to the polls, especially in the evening as they were closing. That said, there was enough enthusiasm, plenty of enthusiasm, because this was a very, very passionate debate. It centered on immigration, it centered on the economy, it centered on sovereignty, issues that touch people very closely. And people seemed to have a very strong opinion one way or another. There were many undecided voters, but even those, when I would interview people, they would have a great deal of anxiety and very much wanted to have a decision, wanted to make a decision. They considered it important enough in their history. Politicians on both sides really touched on people's emotions, saying that this is about the future of their children and their grandchildren.
There have been predictions that if the Leave vote wins and Britain leaves the European Union, that the economy not only of that country but of the EU countries and possibly even outside the EU could suffer. Have you been hearing anything about that?
Well, when you consider that Great Britain is the second largest economy in the EU, it tells you that things will be affected largely, and certainly those effects felt early Thursday when opinion polls showed that the Remain camp might win this referendum. The pound rallied, markets in Europe rallied early in the day. That certainly has changed after more than half of the votes were counted and showed that Leave camp had a almost 2% point lead. That was again very early in the counting. The pound tumbled, and so the effects being felt very much. And of course, it's been a few days of tremendous market volatility, just depending on what the opinion polls were saying.
Prime Minister Cameron led the call to remain in the EU, and I understand that analysts there in Britain are saying his political future hinges on what happens in this voting and that he might have to resign.
Well, much of this debate, the Brexit debate, has happened within the ruling Conservative Party, that's Mr. Cameron's party, and the analysts say that if a Leave vote would be successful, that Cameron will lose his mandate and will have little choice but to step down. That opens the way then for former London Mayor Boris Johnson, very popular, but leading the Leave vote, the Leave campaign. He is favored to take over next. Now, Cameron has said he will not resign. That will be known when he speaks at 10 Downing, when the final result is in.
Many thanks to you, Louise. VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez joining us from London. Time now to check in with International Edition social media expert G. Abby Lee about the online buzz going into Thursday's British referendum. G., what you got?
Hi, Steve. British politicians really took to social media to voice their opinions throughout Thursday. Prime Minister David Cameron was one of them. His handle is @David_Cameron, and his two favorite hashtags to use were #VoteRemain and #StrongerIn. The second hashtag, of course, means his country is stronger as part of the EU. One of his many tweets sent out on Thursday reads like this: "Remember to vote Remain by 10 p.m. tonight to keep Britain stronger, safer, and better off in Europe. #StrongerIn." And although Cameron is the political leader of the country, there is someone far more popular on Twitter, and that's Nigel Farage, who is the leader of the Independence Party.
And what did he tweet?
He's on Twitter @Nigel_Farage and tweeted this Thursday evening local time: "If you want your borders back, if you want your democracy back, if you want your country back, then vote to leave. #IndependenceDay." More than 2,000 people liked it so far, compared to just a couple hundred likes for Mr. Cameron's tweets. Farage is also prolific on Facebook. He posted, "Today's your opportunity to help take back control over our borders. Please get out there, vote, and urge your friends, family, and colleagues to do the same. Every vote matters in this referendum." And not surprisingly, most of the comments to that post echoed his decision. Many people wrote in the comment section that those who have the backbone will vote to leave the EU, and criticized the national broadcaster BBC for what they perceive as biased reporting.
I see. So what was the overriding sentiment?
Steve, on Twitter, many people using the hashtag EUREF expressed a desire to leave the EU, but the view seems to be more neutral on Facebook. That's all for me today. Steve?
Many thanks, UG. International Edition social media expert G. Abby Lee. You can follow G on Twitter. She's @GAbbyLee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and our program, International Edition, is on Twitter at @VOA_IE. And among the top stories we're following this hour, U.S. imposing sanctions on Kinshasa, the police chief there in the DRC. Police attack a Tibetan small business owner as that takes place near a sacred lake. Plus, a new report is out about a quarter of a billion people, they say, ages 15 to 64, using drugs in 2014. We'll have expanded coverage of those stories and a lot more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. Here in Washington, Democrats in the Congressional House of Representatives have ended a 26-hour sit-in in the House chamber. It was an unprecedented protest against what they say is the lack of legislative action on gun violence by their Republican colleagues. VOA's House correspondent Catherine Gibson is following the developments there. International Edition's Michael Lippin speaks with her about the sit-in and what the Democrats think they achieved with that protest.
They felt that they had reached a point, they had reached the 24-hour mark and gone a little bit past it, and they felt that they had made the world aware of their goals and their hopes for legislation. They said that when they come back after the July 4th holiday break, they'll continue this fight, and the break will be an opportunity to talk to their constituents, strategize about next steps forward, and see where they take this fight next.
Well, you know, House Speaker Paul Ryan, he continued his criticism of the sit-in today, saying it was a fundraising tool for the Democrats. Do we know that the Democrats actually were able to raise any money based off of the publicity they got for this protest?
You know, it's unclear if they were able to raise any money. They certainly had a large group of supporters here around Capitol Hill last night through the morning and into today when they ended the sit-in. A lot of people supporting their calls for gun violence legislation. And, you know, I'm certain that the images that were beamed around the world on Periscope and on Facebook Live will do their part in encouraging people to donate to the cause.
What do the Democrats think they can do next to actually achieve progress toward their goal? Are we going to see basically a repeat sit-in after the 4th of July?
They were very careful about answering that question today when they ended their sit-in outside the Capitol. They spoke in very broad terms about next steps, about strategizing, and mostly about building a dialogue with their Republican colleagues. You know, I saw a couple of members of Congress shout out to their Republican colleagues on the House floor late last night trying to start that dialogue. And, of course, they were shouted down, and then there was a back and forth. So we can see if maybe in a little less heated atmosphere, a little bit of that dialogue can begin.
Well, I was just going to ask you, given that there were some House Republicans who were quite angered at how the Democrats were breaking the House rules with this sit-in, do you think that the protest makes the possibility of a compromise between Democrats and Republicans more likely or less likely?
Well, you know, in this partisan atmosphere up on Capitol Hill, I don't know if anything can make things worse, but there was certainly signs of anger, of frustration last night. They were trying to get a vote going. Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan looked visibly frustrated as he tried to gavel everybody into order. He spoke this morning about the need for that order, about the possibility of a process and how the Democrats need to respect that process. He actually said that this was not a good day for democracy. So I think House Republicans will talk a lot about that in the coming days and use that as something against their Democratic colleagues.
That is VOA's Catherine Gibson speaking with my colleague, Michael Lippin. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Colombian government and the leftist FARC rebels signed a ceasefire and disarmament deal Thursday in Havana, Cuba. Court assigned by Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos and FARC leader Rodrigo Londoño. It brings Colombia to a major step closer to ending more than 50 years of guerrilla warfare there, as well as terrorism. The conflict, which began as a peasant revolt in the 1960s and was fueled later by the drug trade, left 220,000 people dead, tens of thousands are missing, and many more millions displaced. In Washington, U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby welcomed the ceasefire.
The United States welcomes the communique and hopes the parties will continue to make progress toward a final peace accord.
We believe it's an important step forward. Look, sometimes diplomacy, particularly this kind of difficult diplomacy, takes time, and it takes a lot of hard work and effort. We believe that it was reached through the hard work and the leadership of many. And in particular, President Santos.
President Santos said the government and the rebels will complete the negotiations for a final peace agreement by July the 20th, including terms of FARC's demobilization, a laying down of arms and security guarantees. It will then be put to the Colombian people in a referendum. Peter Hockham is President Emeritus and Senior Fellow at the Washington-based Inter-American Dialogue. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty this is a major development for both Bogota and the United States.
Not only has it been the longest war, it's probably cost the most lives of any war on the mainland of Latin America, virtually. And it's caused Colombia to be among the countries in the entire world which have the largest displaced population. It created sort of an atmosphere in Colombia that was partly responsible for the emergence of the various large-scale drug managers. Why is that so important to the United States? The United States has invested a huge amount in Colombia, beginning in the late 90s It spent close to $8 to $10 billion over a 10 or 12 year period financing Plan Colombia, with the notion that Colombia was one of the most dangerous countries in the world. It was a major source of drug trafficking. No one can say Colombia has solved all its problems, but rates of violence have gone down. The guerrilla war is winding to an end.
3 years of negotiations in Cuba. Is this a victory for the Cuban leadership as well as the president of Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos?
Juan Manuel Santos deserves a little bit larger applause than the Cubans, but the fact is that that was the one place where the FARC rebels felt comfortable enough, safe enough, to carry out this kind of prolonged negotiation.
Security improvements over the past 6 or so years has meant that Colombia's already reaping a so-called peace dividend.
An enormous progress has been made, there's no question. Homicide rates are way down.
Colombia could be one of the powerhouses of Latin America going forward.
I think it still has a ways to go before it achieves that. It still has a huge population that's poor, huge population that's displaced, areas of the country that need to be developed. I think it's going to take a while before it catches up to the Chile's and Argentina's. But remember one thing also, that Colombia has always been a reasonably well-managed economy. Its economy during the 1980s was the only country that did not default or have its debt reduced. It basically paid off its debt when it was due, and the only country in Latin America.
Meanwhile, security challenges remain between the Colombian government and a second insurgency, the Leftist National Liberation Army, where negotiations have not yet begun. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama and her two daughters are due to visit Liberia soon. They'll also make a stop in Morocco. The host of VOA's Daybreak Africa, James Buddy, is in Liberia's capital, Monrovia, and he speaks now with VOA's William Eagle about Mrs. Obama's visit.
I had a chance to speak with the Minister of Information of Liberia. I think we are told that perhaps the U.S. First Lady might be coming to Liberia by Monday, which is the 27th of June.
What are some of the activities that the First Lady is likely to participate in during her visit?
Mrs. Obama's trip to Liberia, we understand, is part of the Let Girls Learn initiative. This was started in 2015 by President Obama and then First Lady Michelle Obama, as part of the U.S. government's effort to address some of the challenges that are preventing girls, adolescent, young women, from attending and completing their education.
What's the mood in Monrovia in anticipation of Mrs. Obama's visit?
The city and the country, they're excited in anticipation of the First Lady's visit. This morning, I visited a school where Mrs. Obama is supposed to go to meet with young women there who are attending. And I met with the young high school students, grade school, high school students, and they're all excited, looking forward to meeting the First Lady, talking about their education. Some of them are talking to me how they want to finish their education, go on to be doctors, want to be engineers. And I did have a chance also to talk to the vice principal of that school and some of the issues they face about girls coming to school and staying in school. Most often you see some of these girls, they need a social support, and sometimes they start school and don't finish because either they are pregnant. The vice principal told me that once they got help, international help, some of these girls have begun now to stay in school longer and to finish their education. So these are some of the things they hope that the United States will continue to help these girls stay in school through the kind of support that the United States is giving. And, besides, as I was saying also, that the First Lady is also going to travel outside of Monrovia to a place called Kakata to visit another project there. She's going to meet with girls who are participating in another program called the GLOW, which stands for Girls Leading Our World. So she's going to be meeting with these young women.
Host of VOA's Daybreak Africa, James Buddy, speaking from Monrovia with VOA's William Eagle. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
The Goddard Base Tunnel is 57 kilometers long and passes under the Swiss Alps. Just completed, it's the world's longest and deepest rail tunnel, carved out by Sissi, the gigantic tunnel boring machine. Sissi drilled through some 28 million tons of rock to make the tunnel that helps to preserve one of Switzerland's prized possessions, its natural above-ground beauty. Karine Ganot is the director of UK and Ireland Switzerland Tourism.
See, mountains and landscape is actually one of the major reasons why people come and visit Switzerland.
The Goddard Base Tunnel has other benefits as well. Some of the goods that move through the Alps on a million trucks every year can soon be moved by train through the tunnel and at speeds of up to 200 kilometers an hour. Passenger trains will move even faster, and Swiss officials say the tunnel will spark more interest in tourism. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. The U.S. Television Academy, which awards the Emmy Awards for Television Excellence, is suing to stop Whitney Houston's heirs from selling her Emmy statuette because the sale, they say, would tarnish the award. Houston won the Emmy for Outstanding Individual Performance in a Variety or Musical in 1986 for the song Saving All My Love for You, which she performed at the Grammys. International Edition's David Byrd speaks with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the controversy, which could stop the auction later today.
Well, it's a televised broadcast for which Whitney won an Emmy. And so the actual Emmy Award, the statue, along with some other things like her passport, her wedding dress, and other personal items, are being put up for auction. Now, the Television Academy is suing Houston's estate. They want to stop the sale of the statue. And they're making two points. One, that by selling it at auction, it sort of takes away from the prestige of the award. And the second point is that the Television Academy lends these statues to the people who win them. So you win the award, but the statue itself, you don't, as an award winner, technically own. Now, all of these items are going up for auction on Friday, and the Television Academy is asking the courts to not only stop the sale, but while the case is in court, to actually take the statue back so that it doesn't accidentally, and I'm using air quotes here, accidentally get sold while everything is in deliberation.
So it doesn't get lost in delivery or something, right?
Or
we don't
something
know what
like
happened
that.
To it.
Yeah.
Well, now, see, now, the Emmys, I know that for the Oscars, you get the statue that they give you at the ceremony, but then you get like a mini version to take home. Is that
right.
The same thing with the Emmys? And this is the full-size thing they're trying to sell.
This
right?
is the full-size Emmy, and it depends on the category. So if you win an Emmy for one of the televised categories, you get to take home your statue that day. But my assumption is that this was not one of the televised categories. It was sort of like a televised live performance. So I'm assuming that this is a full-size Emmy that was sent to her home sometime after she actually was presented with the honor.
Now, why are they selling this? Do they need money? I wouldn't think Whitney Houston's estate would need money.
Well, that is unclear. And I looked through a number of different stories to see if there was a reason, if the estate was, in fact, in financial trouble. And it doesn't appear to be. So it may just be that, like is usually the case with a lot of these estates, is that there are things worth money that they don't necessarily need or don't necessarily want. So why not cash them out and then perhaps invest them in other things? Or, you know, sometimes these estates end up in tax trouble and you see these kinds of sales and auctions going on so that they can use the cash to pay toward whatever back taxes the artist may have owned.
All right. Oh, so what do you think about this? That Whitney Houston's Emmy up for sale. Should the Television Academy get it? Should the estate get it? Or maybe you'd like to bid on it. I don't know, but let us know your thoughts and feelings by sending a tweet to Shauna Renee. She is at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA underscore music. And we look forward to hearing from you. You can also log on to our Facebook page. That's VOA Now.
And that is VOA's David Byrd along there with Shauna Renee. More news for you. Ralph Stanley, who, along with his brother Carter, helped expand and popularize the music genre that became known as bluegrass, has died. The Stanleys created a distinctive three-part harmony that combined the lead vocal of Carter, Ralph's, of course, tenor, and an even higher part sung by bandmate Pee-wee Lambert. One of their big songs was A Man of Constant Sorrow.
The stage where I was born and raised.
And Stanley's music, like this song, was featured in the film Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Ralph Stanley, 89 years old, when he died on Thursday. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On June 20th, the international community marked World Refugee Day. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, reports there are over 60 million displaced people worldwide, 20 million refugees, and 40 million internally displaced, the largest number since World War II. Humanitarian crises around the world make painfully clear that despite our best efforts, all nations must do more, said United States Ambassador to Botswana Earl Miller. In an editorial marking World Refugee Day, Ambassador Miller noted that too often refugees and asylum seekers are turned away, denied a safe haven, and refouled or expelled. The United States is seeking commitments to expand the humanitarian safety net and create more long-term opportunities for refugees and displaced people worldwide. We call on our friends and partners to rise to the challenge and honor their commitment on protecting refugees' right to life. One of those friends is Botswana. Botswana currently hosts roughly 3,000 refugees at Dukwi Camp who have fled a wide array of conflicts and violence from as far away as Somalia to as close as neighboring Zimbabwe, Ambassador Miller noted. The government of Botswana, in conjunction with UNHCR, provides them with schooling, housing, and medical treatment. The U.S. government is working to assist where we can. We help fund the camp's healthcare system, in addition to providing small grants to organizations that offer skills training and safe spaces for the camp's youth. We are working with the government of Botswana and UNHCR to find durable solutions for these refugees. Since 1975, the United States Refugee Admissions Program welcomed over 3.2 million resettled refugees from around the world. In each of the last 3 years, the United States has resettled nearly 70,000 refugees, and this year we aim to resettle up to 85,000. In addition, President Barack Obama announced the United States will admit 100,000 in 2017. The Refugee Admissions Program offers the world's most vulnerable refugees the opportunity to find safety and start over in communities across the United States. While the scope of the global refugee and displaced persons crisis is massive, our humanitarian response can be as well, Ambassador Miller concluded. By welcoming refugees, we reaffirm our common humanity and our commitment to building a common peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.